Welcome. Lawrence Katz joins us today for part two of our conversation. Today's topic is the Moving to Opportunity Demonstration, one of the most important studies of poverty and the effects of neighborhoods in the United States. Professor Katz, an economics professor at Harvard University, helped lead the long-term 15-year evaluation of Moving to Opportunity, or MTO. Some brief background. MTO was a randomized social experiment sponsored by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. It launched in 1994 and involved almost 5,000 families with children living in high-poverty public housing projects in five cities: Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, L.A., and New York City. Professor Katz, start us off by describing the motivation for the experiment. In other words, what were the key questions it was trying to test?
So in the case of Moving to Opportunity, there is a lot of evidence in our eyes, anywhere you look, as well as systematic social science evidence that say, you know, there's systematic differences in outcomes for people who live in different types of neighborhoods, both for adults living in higher income neighborhoods versus lower income neighborhoods, more versus less segregated, have very different outcomes. And everything you can control for people that we see in standard data sets doesn't knock that out. People living in higher income neighborhoods end up, you know, with higher earnings, more stable employment, their kids go farther in school, their kids are less likely to be involved in crime, people who grow up in those neighborhoods end up with better jobs, longer life expectancies. One hypothesis is that the neighborhood resources, peer connections themselves have huge effects on people's outcomes, and that if we could take policy steps to reduce, you know, income segregation and residential segregation, this by itself would be a tremendous anti-poverty policy, would greatly increase educational attainment. But a worry from that sort of observation, which there's tons of good evidence, is that there are a lot of things we can't measure. If we have two families of modest income and one finds a way to get into, you know, a neighborhood that has better schools and a somewhat safer neighborhood, are we learning about the true treatment effect of that neighborhood, or are we learning about the differences in the types of families that move there? The kids from that family would do better regardless because their parents, you know, are willing to sacrifice more for their education.
So a key question of what's the effect of a neighborhood on well-being and on poverty. And that question was tested for the first time with a randomized experiment with MTO, but there had been other studies beforehand. Is that right?
There were a lot of promising quasi-experiments before MTO where there were particular policy actions, like in Chicago. There was an anti-discrimination suit against Chicago Public Housing that led to a finding in the 80s against Chicago, which became the Gautreaux quasi-experiment, where people living, African-American families living in public housing, were given opportunities to get vouchers to move to less segregated areas. And some initial analysis by people like James Rosenbaum at Northwestern, which greatly motivated Moving to Opportunity, found huge effects, but there were real problems. The families that moved to suburbs, and they found a number of years later, were doing much better than other families that looked somewhat comparable. But even there, without a true experiment going on, there were difficulties that, you know, maybe the types of families that were willing to wait around till they got called with one of these, you know, vouchers to go to the suburbs were different than the ones that would have moved to another area. Maybe the ones that persist in those neighborhoods were different, and there was huge attrition. So the promise of both these things motivated an attempt to do a true random assignment experiment.
So Larry, tell us about the study design. I know there were two program groups, also called treatment groups, and one control group. How was the study structured to get at this question of what is the effect of place and housing on poverty and other measures of well-being?
Basically, what we did is we operated in five U.S. cities, and eligible families were living in public housing projects. This is in the 1990s, that had an over 40% poverty rate in their census tract of their project as of 1990 census. So these are some of the poorest, you know, if you think of poor, high density, you know, dangerous neighborhoods, you know, these were the Robert Taylor Homes, Cabrini Green projects in Roxbury, in Massachusetts, in Dorchester. You know, these were high poverty, high crime areas, and families in those areas were given the opportunity. This actually came out of the 1992 Housing and Urban Bill, which was somewhat motivated by the aftermath of the Rodney King riot in Los Angeles, when Congress, I think, found urban problems salient for at least a short period of time, put some demonstration money into the Urban and Housing Bill. And so the random assignment here is among those families who signed up, essentially one third of them were offered a regular, what was then called Section 8 voucher, now Housing Choice. So they would have the same thing that anyone. And why would someone in public housing want a Section 8 voucher? It gives you the same amount of purchasing power for housing, but it gives you freedom where to move to, much more so. So there were many year long lines of waits, 8-10 years to get a Section 8 voucher in these cities. So we created these extra vouchers out of the act to allow people by lottery to get a regular Section 8 voucher. So that's testing the standard Section 8 voucher program against public housing. And then to really change the neighborhoods, we had one group where they were lotteried into having a Section 8 voucher, but it could only be used in a census tract that had an under 10% poverty rate, below the national average as of 1990. But we gave them help to try to find housing with housing counselors at each of those sites.
Great.
So there is a control group, one group that has a regular Section 8 voucher, and one group that has special help moving to low poverty areas, but they can only use their voucher to move to low poverty areas. Okay.
And importantly, for the study design, there was random assignment of program participants to these different groups, either to one of the two program groups or to a control group that didn't receive any of these fast-track vouchers. In other words, they received the status quo.
Yeah, so the control group kept getting its normal, public housing support. And over the years, we've tracked, this happened in the mid-90s, and we've tracked them over 15 years. Actually, many people in the control group eventually ended up getting housing vouchers, although usually not voluntarily, because many of the housing projects they were living in were demolished. And when they were demolished, they were then given housing vouchers, but not necessarily moving at a time of their choice.
It's a good reminder of how in a randomized control trial, you're comparing a program group against the status quo. Some of the status quo members, some of the control group members may receive services, like in this case, receiving vouchers, through other means. So moving on now to the findings. Larry, before we get to the impact on things like income and poverty, tell us about the basic question of what's the extent to which people who receive these vouchers move to lower poverty areas?
So we track these 5,000 households, almost 5,000 adults and 11,000 kids, over the next 15 years. And what we found, the first fact is that if you give them vouchers, they really can move to different types of neighborhoods. So there is a treatment in changing the neighborhoods. Particularly, one worry is that very few people with these restricted vouchers would actually be able to lease up. Almost 50% of the people offered these vouchers got into low poverty areas, and the typical family that moved into a low poverty area tended to persist there. And so over 15 years, people in the sort of restricted voucher group on average lived in areas that had sort of 18 percentage point lower poverty, in their neighborhood than people in the control group. So that's a very large change. That's sort of moving from being in a typical 40%, poverty neighborhood to sort of being in a 15 to 20% poverty neighborhood. These are huge improvements in their neighborhoods. Also, if you look both at their subjective measures of how safe they were, objective measures of crime rates, who their neighbors were, things like access to fresh fruits and vegetables, large changes in where they were living, and they persist. The Section 8 group is somewhere in between. They're moving to better neighborhoods than the control group, but not anything like the experimental group.
So finally, Larry, the big question. Tell us about the findings of the study, the impacts on families of moving to a lower poverty neighborhood, and your interpretation about why those findings occurred.
The thing we learned, both in the short and the longer run, is neighborhoods have profound effects on these families, but one shouldn't necessarily think of these sorts of neighborhood moves as an anti-poverty policy per se. What they really impact on is safety, stress, things, you know, being in a safer, less stressful, less dangerous area, which was actually the primary motivation of these families when we asked them at baseline why they wanted to move, was concern of safety of their kids, violence, you know, gangs and crime. It clearly delivered on that. Much less likely to be victimized. And this shows up both in subjective measures of mental health and the most objective measures we could do on things like depression and psychological distress. It shows up over time in physical health indicators. Obesity is dramatically reduced by moving to a low poverty area, and all sorts of indicators of stress. Diabetes, which is, you know, very much a stress and obesity related thing, is, you know, looks it would pass sort of a drug trial on the impacts on obesity and diabetes. So substantial improvements in mental and physical health, and a summary measure of the adult household head of sort of happiness, subjective well-being, large impacts, you know, about changes in measures of happiness and well-being that are sort of would be equivalent to sort of doubling incomes in this group, sort of $20,000 in income. So if you're letting the families themselves give the scorecard of, you know, what they're feeling, you know, the great improvements in neighborhood satisfaction, but despite all that, very, very little impact on, you know, outcomes like labor market earnings, employment, kids' educational attainment. It does keep kids out of the riskiest, you know, most dangerous criminal activity. Some reduction there doesn't change that much property crime involvement. So the way we see it, it has profound impacts on well-being and health. But think of the adults in this experiment. If you have limited education and not a lot of job experience, even though I moved you 10 miles away to a place that has, you know, a lot of middle-class jobs, you're not likely to be very much considered for it. You could work as a home health aide 10 miles away or where you were living before and have a very similar type of job. You might be safer in this other area, but your earnings are not much affected. And the other thing we learned is that school quality did not change nearly as much as neighborhood quality. And that's the nature of learning about basically housing vouchers in the U.S. That is, even though we were moving them to areas where their neighbors were much better off and they were much safer, typically the value of a housing voucher, which only pays sort of the 40th percentile rent in a metropolitan area, is not enough to get you in the attendance zone of the really good schools. So while in terms of neighborhoods, we move people from sort of the bottom 5% of neighborhoods in terms of how rich their neighbors were, in terms of how, you know, in terms of safety, to sort of the 40th percentile neighborhood. So we greatly changed their neighborhoods. You know, we didn't solve the Lake Wobegon problem. You can't take, you know, everyone and move them above the mean. They're still limited income households. So we greatly changed their neighborhoods, but their schools, some of it is good news. Even if you live in the highest poverty areas in cities like Boston and New York and Chicago these days, because of the growth of public school choice and charter schools and stuff, lots of people in the control group are actually in better schools than their neighborhoods. So in terms of schools, the control group's living in the 5th percentile neighborhood, but they're sort of in the 15th percentile schools on average, because some of them are getting into better schools. The treatment people, they, you know, are living sort of 40th percentile neighborhoods, but they're only in like the 20th percentile school. So schools barely changed. Because we had 5 sites and we have sort of 3 treatment groups by site, 15 groups, there's enough variation that in several of the sites, school quality, you know, you could move to areas with better schools. When the schools improved, then you did see the kids' educational outcomes and risky behavior outcomes improving. Neighbors really matter for health and well-being, but for the kids' long-run outcomes in terms of economic education, the schools are sort of crucial.
My thanks to Lawrence Katz for sharing his insights about this important study of poverty in place. Thanks for listening.